Today, February 19th is observed as the Day of Remembrance in some American communities. This is the anniversary of the day in 1942 when President Franklin Roosevelt signed an executive order sending a total of 120,000 Americans of Japanese descent into prison camps. Our next guest was one of those Americans. Roy Saigo was just a toddler when his family was sent from California to a camp in Arizona. He speaks about that part of his life and the aftermath this afternoon at 3:30 at Southern Oregon University. Roy Saigo is the former interim president of Southern Oregon University. Retiring in 2016. He came to SOU from St. Cloud State University in Minnesota, the latest in a handful of academic executive jobs. Roy Saigo was born in Sacramento and received degrees from the University of California, Davis, and Oregon State University. And a pleasure to have you in this studio for the first time, Dr. Saigo. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeff. What a pleasure to be here today in our new facilities.
So your parents immigrated from Japan. I understand your mother was actually born in the United States, but she had moved to Japan, and then she and your father moved to this country together?
That's correct, Jeff. My mother's family had come from the Osaka area, and they ran a hotel in San Francisco. And unfortunately, after her baby sister was born, the mother died in childbirth. And so the father and her two brothers and herself were shipped back to Japan. And unfortunately, during that time, the food crew, would not give her any milk. And so she told me that she had to chew food and try to spit it into the child's mouth. But of course, the child died en route back. And so, you know, her memories of those kinds of times are very difficult.
So what was it that prompted your parents to leave Japan and come to the United States permanently?
That's an excellent question, Jeff, because my family... the Saigo family is an iconic family in Japan. Saigo Takamori has a statue in Ueno Park in Tokyo. And he came from an island called Kamakura. And the interesting part about that is that I believe the woman had come from the island with a cache of swords, which was equivalent to money, and with a baby son. And so that is where my lineage came. And our family was fairly well off, but even well-off families with land would come to the United States from those areas, work for a few years in California or Oregon, make some money, and then return. And so that's how they got here.
Was there ever an intent from your branch of the family, your mother and father, to return to Japan?
From what I understand, no. When we were in Japan visiting, walking down the street, we met a white-haired woman, and we were introduced, and she introduced herself. And it was fascinating because she was a cousin, and she says, I was supposed to go to America, but she had a cold. So they left her with a cousin, and she was left behind. And so, again, colds and illnesses and wellness all fit into the future of your lives, and she didn't come to the United States.
Wow.
And as my parents were here, you know, they made a living, made some money, and then they'd return to Japan for a few years until they went low again, and then would come back.
So you were what, two, maybe not even two?
Two,
when,
three, yeah.
When Executive Order 9066 came down on this date, right, in 1942, saying Americans of Japanese descent could be removed, particularly from the West Coast, and sent to internment camps. Where was your family sent?
Well, we were in Vacaville. That's between Sacramento and San Francisco. And it was interesting because it was a little village of Japanese from that region. So they all kind of knew each other, had the same customs. And the dialect, you know, and Japanese dialects are very different from the northern part, the southern part in Tokyo. And so it was a comfortable life at that time. My mother and father, I had my older brother and sister, and I was just born. And so I met a student and his family here at SOU, and they were from Vacaville. And the father said to me he would go down to the creek and and he found a bunch of artifacts. And he still has a little medicine bottle intact with a little cork in the end. And he says, I was wondering why that happened. And I remember my parents saying during that really unfortunate time that when we were asked to leave and being rounded up, we had to decide what we are going to do with the materials that we had. And so we took all of our dishes, all of our memorabilia, tea sets, pictures, family albums, private papers, things that we didn't want our neighbors to be thumbing through and walking through our house, down to the creek in a little ravine, threw gasoline all over it, threw all the dishes and things, porcelain, and destroyed them.
So a lot of family photos, a lot of memorabilia just didn't survive.
Exactly, Jeff. And as I look back and as I am older now, we really destroyed our history. We have no history. We have no pictures of my family. We have no pictures of my parents' wedding. We have no pictures of any of the cousins or relatives. And so we had to get rid of things that we couldn't carry. And so as we were being rounded up, we had 10 days, and we talk about what would you do if you were in our place? What would you do with your car, with your family albums, with your priceless heirlooms, guns, and things that might be seen as controversial to the government? And so we just destroyed all of that. Some families were fortunate that they had neighbors that took care of this stuff for them.
So given you were five, maybe, when you got out of the camp, do you have many memories yourself from being in Gila River, Arizona?
Well, again, it's an interesting thing because some of it is memory and, of course, some from family, some from reading. And my parents are interesting. I think a lot of the Japanese Americans felt this way, that it was a shameful time and that they did not talk about it very much. And when we would try to bring it up, my parents would use these words, shigatanai. And Japanese word for shigatanai means that there's nothing you can do about it, so forget it. And then the other that I would hear, Jeff, was gambare. Gambare means to tighten your belt and tough it through. You can't do anything about it, so just forget it and move on. And so kind of a time where we wanted to put that awful time behind you, look forward and make do what you can with what you can control. We could not control what happened to us.
Did you in later years, as your parents got older, did they get more willing to talk about their experiences?
No.
really? That was it. She got the nai.
That was it. She got the nai. And as I read numerous books from the Issei, the people who had immigrated here, like my parents.
You're Nisei, right?
Nisei is second generation. And the people born here. But those individuals blamed themselves. They felt that had they been more American, had they been more visible, had they been more visible in speaking about their loyalty to this country, that they would not have been put behind barbed wire. And so it's a curious mental condition of the people from that time.
Blaming themselves, in essence, for being imprisoned. So out in what, 1945?
Yes.
What were your family circumstances upon release?
Well, at that time, Jeff, people, as I visit, will say, well, you're released and you can go home now. And I ask people, you know, we had no home. We had no belongings. At that time, because of the laws, we couldn't even buy a house. We couldn't buy property.
Couldn't own land.
In California. And so luckily, at the very, very end of our time in Gila River, Arizona, we got to a place called Florin near Sacramento, And luckily, there was a Buddhist church and had a gymnasium. And there they housed numerous families with, remember, cotton cord rope and with cots and blankets hung over the rope to separate the families. We stayed there for quite a while. And a man that came by needed a foreman to run his rented ranches, Mylon Johnston. And I still know his daughter and daughters and the family. But he had land way out in the outskirts east of Sacramento called Slough House. And so we were directed there, and my father ran ranches for him, raising asparagus, tomatoes, hops, pears, peaches, what have you. And we had two or three other Japanese-American families who had been released from camp.
Now, I understand you spent a fair amount of time as you were growing up working on the farm as well.
And, yeah.
not really relishing the work from the sounds of it.
Well, we went from there to Franklin, which is near Elk Grove, which is close to Sacramento also.
And you went to Elk Grove High School?
Elk Grove High School, the Thundering Herd, and had a wonderful life there. We raised for the Johnstons 125 head of dairy cows and peach and pear farms. And I remember throwing silage every morning to 125 cows. And I never had a date in high school, and I always thought it was my looks, but it was really my smell. If you ever was on a dairy farm. And I remember I would complain to my father, and I'll say, you know what, this is not very much fun, scooping manure and stuff and milking cows and a very tough life. And he says, well, then go to school. And what an incentive, Jeff. And so you know why I spent so much time at universities, because had it not been for public education for this immigrant family's son, I could not have had a life beyond what I was used to.
So that was quite a long journey then from getting into UC Davis yourself into the whole career in university, in teaching and administration. Roy Saigo's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the Day of Remembrance, the 78th anniversary of the signing of the executive order that put Japanese Americans, including Roy and his family, into camps during the Second World War. So you described your life in high school as a wonderful life, not crazy about the farm part of it, but let's talk about the attitudes toward people who looked like you and that. Were you constantly reminded of your heritage by people who didn't share it?
That's correct. We were fortunate because I grew up with Filipinos, Mexicans, Japanese, whites, and we were like a bunch of chickens all thrown together. And, you know, we just had a marvelous time. We played sports and ran for student body offices and all of that. And was pretty much welcome. What comes is from the older people. And during World War II, I don't know if you know about this, but even previous to the war, there's caricatures and a lot of publicity about the Japanese, and we were characterized as sneaky, almost animal-like in behavior and looks.
And even Dr. Seuss, I noticed, had a cartoon that showed Japanese people looking across the ocean with telescopes to get their orders from Japan.
Correct. And they did surveys, and the newspapers were not helpful either, Jeff. McClatchy, there's a high school called McClatchy High School, and we used to play them in baseball and football, but the Sacramento Bee, the LA Times, the Oregonian, all of these major newspapers you think would be fair. And they were as prejudiced and almost political in their demonizing of the Japanese and the Japanese Americans.
You know, it's incredible when you look back at the newspaper headlines, and these are not even on the editorial pages, but you're talking about, you know, the headlines in the just on the front page of the paper, you know, Jap this, Jap that.
It was some exactly, and that term is equivalent to the N-word that we are forbidden to even speak now, but it has the same biting connotation. And as I looked into my friend Yasue, and there is a book called The Troubled Twig about the Yasues and Hood River. And it's amazing the newspapers and the citizens of Hood River, where so many Japanese Americans were raising fruit. And the thing that really caught my attention, especially, was the Legion Post 22. And they listed all the veterans, and they had initially put the 14 Nisei soldiers, two of whom were killed and 10 had purple hearts, and they scrubbed those from the plaque. And this became public in the Saturday Evening Post and on, and the National Legion Post threatened them that if they didn't put those back, they'll be removed from the post. They put it back with the caveat that that does not change our attitude.
Hmm.
So this is in Hood River, Oregon.
Right, right, where, as you pointed out, quite a few Japanese-American families had settled. What did your parents tell you, Roy, growing up about how you should deal with people who insulted you or discriminated against you?
Well, you know, when my siblings came back, I still remember to this day. My older brother and sister were like 7 years older than I and my brother. My eldest brother was about 14 to 15, and I still remember this vividly, Jeff, where he was a freshman in Elk Grove High School, and the upperclassmen would make the freshmen, especially these minorities, crawl between the legs of the upperclassmen, and they would take their belts out and spank them as they went through. And I remember my mother having my brother lower his pants and dabbing his butt with iodine. And, of course, he was screaming because iodine in those days would burn like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, can you imagine your father and mother, very proud people, who had no control or no voice or nothing to retaliate and to minimize the pain of their children? And being a parent and a grandparent today, I can't even get within their brains of how they would adjust to that injustice done to their families.
Roy Saigo is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about growing up as a Japanese American, actually in an internment camp for a few years when he was very, very young at Gila River, Arizona. This is the Day of Remembrance, the day we remember the signing of the executive order that put the Japanese Americans into internment camps during Second World War. Roy will speak on civil rights for all, keeping the message alive this afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Honors College at Suzanne Holmes Hall at Southern Oregon University. He's here now in the studio with us if you'd like to join our conversation. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And here's an email from Scott in Ashland who writes, "Many of us, particularly those who identify as Democrats, look on Franklin Roosevelt as a heroic figure for his leadership in times of depression and war and for his transformative domestic policies. I wonder how Dr. Saigo, as a victim of what was possibly President Roosevelt's worst action in office, feels about Roosevelt." That's from Scott in Ashland.
Well, that's a good question, but going back, it is amazing the amount of information that had been shared. There's a fellow named Fahey, who was a solicitor general during that time, and they had a ringer research from the Naval Intelligence who basically found that there was no threat of Fifth Column, spies, espionage, any of that. Even J. Edgar Hoover said there was no Fifth Column or spying. All that information during that time had been buried. And when the Supreme Court judged that we should be interned during that 1948 period, that this information had not come out. Under Obama, we had Solicitor General Kataei who brought this forward. We would not have known this had not this new Solicitor General, who is of Asian Indian background, brought that forward. And so Fahey was given jobs, had been recognized as being a wonderful civil servant, all these things that went by, but he had hid the information that the Supreme Court had to look at in order to decide on incarcerating 120,000 Americans.
Charles Fahey lived a long life, I see. Went on to become a circuit judge and a judge in the Court of Appeals for the District
That's
of
correct.
Columbia Circuit. So a very busy guy. But you know, so this brings us back, though, to what to make of, because it's not just Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, Earl Warren, in his capacity as Attorney General of California, was solidly behind
this. He was Attorney General, Jeff, and then became Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Right. And so as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the Warren Court is the one that's famous for decisions like Brown versus Board of Education and a number of civil rights rulings that changed how we view people who don't look the same in this country.
Well, and then he said at that time that he can tell the difference of loyalty between the Caucasians and the Japanese, intimating that no matter who we are, if you're white, you're okay. And you also know that with the LA Times and the Sacramento Bee and Oregonian, they all were recognizing us as evil people. The LA Times said basically that a Jap is a Jap. DeWitt, who was the commander for the West Northwest area, basically said, you know, doesn't matter who you are. If you're of Japanese ancestry, you can't be trusted. The former governor, Pierce, of Oregon, ex-governor, said that, you know, if we can just change the Constitution and get rid of these people, it'd be the best thing that could happen to the United States. So basically, we had such a propaganda issue. We had a war issue. We had information that was hidden that really stacked the cards against us. And so, again, going back to Roosevelt and others and citizens, in 1946, the LA Times did a survey, and 90% of the people still felt that we had been spies. And so the propaganda was very effective. And even to this day, I think many of the individuals that look at us and had cousins, brothers, sisters, uncles, neighborhood people had been killed or wounded during World War II still see us as enemies.
Is it a conscious choice then not to be angry about that, or have you been?
Well, I think my parents drummed it into us that it's shigatanai. And so you can't do anything about it, so move on. But it has affected the core value of what I have lived in order to become an administrator. And so as I have administrated three universities, Jeff, I speak for those who have no voice. And so I have an understanding of others who have not the wealth, not the genetic genes to do the things that you want to do, but to be judged by others by the way you look and have no voice is an important thing that I can do for our society.
So how strongly have you worked for things like diversity on campus and the various places you've worked?
That's been my strength and my weakness.
Your weakness?
Yes. You can only push what the community will allow. And so as you move forward, you can always do the best you can do until it becomes untenable. And it's been times where I've had to put my job and my family on the line. And even to this day, there are people out there who don't like the kind of push that we have been doing. And this is why we have Trump having been elected. And I think there's 45% of the population that still feel this way. And so I'm going on a limb, but I'm no longer president.
So you can be a little more free about your what you say.
Yeah, exactly. But if I don't speak up, who will, Jeff? One time in St. Cloud, I was speaking to a women's academic group, about 50 women of educated. They were the leaders of the community. And I remember speaking about this, and a lady who was the wife of a board of trustees. And in the middle of my speech, she stood up, and she exclaimed, "Well, hell, what do you expect? You were the enemy."
So you just described one incident where a woman said, well, hell, you were the enemy. But you lived and traveled in several places, I mean, north and south, Wisconsin, Louisiana, Alabama. You were at Auburn University of Montgomery. How different did you find the culture and the just the general feeling about issues of race to be in those places?
Excellent question again, Jeff. I have found I'll be 80 this summer. And as I have traveled and worked in higher education for 70 years, it's interesting that change the location, change the names, and you basically have the same people. And so I know my friends across this nation feel that maybe the South is more difficult, we're a little bit more liberal and all that. That's not the truth. People are the same wherever you go. Just change the names. The personalities are basically the same.
So you didn't get a stronger reaction to you or any of the things you were doing relative to diversity on any of the campuses?
It's here in Oregon. It's here in California. California is an interesting case because I wrote an article for the Higher Education Chronicle. It's a higher education newspaper about 10 years ago. And there was only two Asian American presidents in the whole Cal State University system. And I criticized them because they had about 30% of the faculty who were Asian Americans. And they would say, well, we didn't have any presidents because we had nobody in the pipeline. Well, they have people in the pipeline now because the pipeline for leadership comes from the academic faculty. And still, they have very few in the four-year university system. And so that tells me that there's discrimination across this nation. And you would think of any place in the United States that would be more amenable to having diversity would be California.
And the University of California system.
That's
specifically,
correct.
Yeah. Let's take a call here. William in Sutherland, thanks for your patience. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roy Saigo.
Yeah, Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Very good. Say, there's a really good movie, and the whole family could watch it, about this subject, and it's called I Remember April.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen it?
I have not. And how old
is
the movie?
Great. It's about a bunch of kids in California, and they're running around together. I think there was four of them. One of them is a Japanese-American. And they're all buddies, and they go down, and because at that time, you know, there was so much concern about the Japanese actually attacking the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So they go out on patrol, and they're out on patrol, you know, just kids. And they go down to the beach, and one day they go down there, and they find this Japanese sailor. Well, actually, he had hidden in this old mill.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to spoil the story for everybody, but it's really a heartwarming movie.
Okay, so yeah.
If you get a chance to see it, watch it.
Okay, thanks for that, William. Appreciate it. And I see that it's a 1999 film with Mark Harmon, Pat Morita, Pam Dauber, Haley Joel Osment, and Yuki Tokuhiro. Have you ever heard of the movie, Roy?
No, I have not. But thank you. I appreciate that.
Let's talk about popular depictions then. I mean, has the story, you feel, been adequately told of what happened at internment camps?
You know, snow falling on cedar mm-hmm. was supposed to be something of that nature. And a very heartwarming book on a love story. But most of the movies that I've seen had been the wars, and it's almost like the American Indians circling the pioneers and being blown up. I think there's been a couple of stories on the Battalion 442. And, you know, the Japanese-American battalion is the most awarded battalion in the history of American warfare. And during the 1940s, when they had given all these medals and things, there was only one Medal of Honor that was awarded. And it was in 1996 that they awarded, by looking through the history and the write-ups of the battles, to increase that to 21 Medals of Honor. So even during the war, when the Japanese Americans were fighting for the United States, there was still racism.
Does each generation have to learn this anew? I mean, do you feel like we make steady progress? You mentioned that, you know, roughly 45% of Americans, based on the 2016 election results, feel that maybe we've done enough in racial progress. Does each generation have to learn this anew?
Well, it's not in our DNA, Jeff. It doesn't translate. And that's why education is so important.
So we're not born racist, you're saying?
That's right. And so, again, I spoke to the seventh grade in Fort Jones, California. These kids were wonderful. I spoke to 46 of these children in Scotts Valley. And, you know, it's a very conservative place. But I asked the students to go on this trip with me. And they had to imagine themselves being in my shoes, of being of a different color, of being of different culture, of being of different food systems, and that they're being treated this way. You know, children have the most wonderful sense of equality, and that they came along with me, they asked wonderful questions, and that only through empathy can we start changing the attitudes of our community.
Do children lose that, though? I mean, they lose innocence in other ways, obviously, but I wonder if the open-mindedness that you see in children of a certain age gets rubbed out when their friends start acting a certain way. And it's like, hey, why are you hanging out with so-and-so, and why don't you join us in beating up this, you know? I mean, do you, that sort of thing seems to get infectious in
exactly.
groups.
Exactly, and, you know, when I deal with higher education here in Oregon or anywhere, I find that many of the students, when they do surveys in Oregon, that in the fifth or sixth grade, many of the minorities are being bullied. But bullying is not just limited to minorities, but it's across the community. And I told these students that if they can understand what the other people's thinking, if they can place themselves in the other person's shoes, they'll become the most successful person they can be. Not the richest, but the most successful. And if we can get students when they're young and impressionable at that time to understand the feelings of the other person, Jeff, we would eliminate bullying. We would eliminate a lot of the meanness that's taking place today. Unfortunately, we're seeing such political animosity that's going to linger into our everyday community.
That's interesting, though, because you measure success in a way that is not usually the top of people's list. Success does tend to be measured in dollars in this country, doesn't it?
And, you know, in some European countries, they are teaching as a course to learn empathy. But it's a sad thing that human behavior that I believe is innate has to be taught.
So how do you counter what must be a fairly alluring message, because people seem to grab onto it, the idea that we've done enough, that we can stop helping people used to be disadvantaged?
Yeah, and again, we see homeless in Oregon. It's difficult to empathize and to assist those who are less benefited from society. We have a tendency to categorize individuals as lazy and not working very hard. And so this is not, you know, it's not unlike what we experience. You get a prejudicial form, you fit people into it, and then you categorize and push them aside. And so as educators, we have to do so much, and as parents, we have to do so much to have our students and our children understand the mentality of those that are less fortunate. And only then, when we become more empathetic to our society, will we have a safer and kinder place. And it's going to take work.
A lot of work still. Let's take a call here from Bob in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Roy Saigo.
Hey, I'm from Bainbridge Island. And maybe Roy knows the history of that area. But that was the first place where it was where snow falling on cedars was placed and was the first area that had internments. And I grew up with many of the families that were sent away to internment camps. And my parents also grew up with the Japanese American population there. And I just thought you know, one of the things that we always really supported the Japanese people, and local newspaper wrote a lot about objecting to the internment program. But one of the things that was going on there was a top secret military base there, a radio intercept station. Mm-hmm. And there was a significant amount of espionage going on, not necessarily by Japanese Americans, but they were intercepting it. And I just thought I'd ask Roy his comments on that, or if he knew anything of that, had anything, any information on that story.
Okay, thanks for that, Bob. Appreciate it. So you mentioned snow falling on Cedar. So you...
Yeah, and again, I feel that a lot of the pre and during propaganda really affected the comments and feelings of the people we have today. I go back and I read this book on my friend's family in Hood River and the animosity of the community. This one fellow, Sutton, listed 500 signatures of community. 2 weeks later, he had another 150 and signed that all the Japs should go back to where they came from. There was a minister who spoke out against this and assisted the Japanese in buying grocery, helping them get gasoline for their trucks, helping them get medical assistance. And he had a little fruit stand. Nobody would buy from him, so that closed. And he was then transferred to a Willamette, a smaller church in the Willamette Valley than the Hood River. And so the hatred that is caused by the propaganda all through and after the war affected the behavior of so many people. And if people would say, well, you know, had I stood up against this one guy who published their names and signatures, but again, I come back and say, yeah, but you had a choice and you weren't willing to stand up. And it's so difficult in any society to stand up against a bully. But this is one man who got 500 signatures of the community to write that we didn't want any more Japs in Hood River. What a legacy. And so when they started to scrub the Nisei soldiers from the plaque that stood at the county entrance of the county building, members, a local soldier came back and said, you know, I fought along with the 442 and that these are really reputable people. Only then did the community start to change. But what a shameful, shameful history of the people who stood up and wrote that we are against the Japanese Americans. And it's so easy to say that, you know, we'd have been ostracized, we'd have been ruined because of our business. But the minister stood up, a doctor stood up. But until we have enough people of courageous being who have a core value of respecting their neighbors, we can't come to a place where we can call ourselves civilized.
So it takes standing up. It takes being counted among the people who have the best of intentions. Roy Saigo has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the former interim president at Southern Oregon University. He'll be speaking on civil rights for all, keeping the message alive this afternoon from 3:30 to 5 at the Honors College inside Suzanne Holmes Hall, just uphill from the Schneider Museum of Art in Ashland, if you're familiar with the campus. And thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Roy, it's been a pleasure to have you.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much, and I'd like to thank Sherriston Lyon, the director of the Honors Program. She has done a wonderful job in bringing attention to the Days of Remembrance, and her leadership has been tremendous in helping bring this to the public. Thank you, Sherriston.